and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. This week, our subject is actor Joan Crawford. Crawford was one of Hollywood's first major stars as it transitioned from the silent era to talkies. And by the late 1930s, she had already delivered a slate of powerful performances, co-starring with some of the heaviest hitters of that era, Clark Gable, Spencer Tracy, Greta Garbo, William Powell, Norma Shearer. She won an Oscar for her performance in the 1945 noir classic Mildred Pierce and would receive two further nominations in 1948 and 1953. After a few years of playing smaller roles in smaller films, Crawford would have a comeback of sorts, co-starring with her real-life nemesis and frequent antagonist Bette Davis in the blockbuster Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Unfortunately, that success led Crawford to a series of roles in low-budget horror thrillers like Straitjacket and I Saw What You Did for self-professed schlockmeister William Castle. Having spent years crafting an image as being difficult, she ended her career doing films for producer Herman Cohen, the 1967 circus thriller Berserk, and then in 1970 with the lowest of the low, Trog. Here to talk about Trog and Joan Crawford, not necessarily in that order, is Joan Crawford mega fan, author Erin Entrada Kelly. Hi, Erin.
Hello, Rob. Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Thank you for doing this. I'm really excited. When I first came up with the notion of doing Fade Out, which is, you know, talking about actors' final films, this was always at the top of my list to talk about it. Not because I want to rag on Joan Crawford, because I don't. Despite this show being about people's final films, I'm not in the business of like dumping on somebody necessarily. But to me, this is a wonderful example of someone who had an amazing career, and then that cannot necessarily end the way you want it to, because this is really, this is a dismal movie. It's a sad way for Joan Crawford to go out. But I wanted to have you on because, A, you're my friend, and we've done a podcast before, and you're great to talk to. But also, I know you're a Joan Crawford fan, and I want to celebrate Joan Crawford because she was really one of the great actresses in all of Hollywood. So how did it all get started? How did you become a fan of Joan Crawford's movies in the first place?
So I have been a fan of silent films since I was a kid. Whenever I was, you know, like 10, 11, 12, I always had trouble sleeping. So I would sneak into the living room and I would turn on the TV. And at the time, of course, we had limited channels. So I think it was American Movie Classics, classic movies. They would show silent films in the middle of the night, you know, when no one's really watching TV. So I started watching Charlie Chaplin, Mary Pickford, wow, all these old movies. So I just kind of developed a fascination with old Hollywood. And that includes, of course, Joan Crawford, who started in silent films and kind of was one of the few actresses who was successful in both and was able to kind of cross over. And I just find her incredibly fascinating. You know, I don't know if she's someone that I would be friends with or that someone that I would want to invite over for dinner per se, you know, I mean, maybe to like drill her brain, but as a person, as a woman working in Hollywood and everything that entailed at the time for women, she's incredibly fascinating, especially whenever you juxtapose her with her rival Bette Davis, right? Cause they were two very similar and dissimilar women. So I just kind of developed, you know, of course she's best known now for Mommy Dearest,
which is a tragedy, you know.
It really is. I mean, it's, I guess it depends on how you look at it. And I'm not out here to say that she was this wonderful woman and an incredible mom and all this other stuff, but she contained multitudes, right? As Walt Whitman says. Right. So she's just fascinating on every level, incredibly talented, very driven. She's just a very interesting person.
She had an amazing voice, and I always think about that story I heard about Ronald Colman, the great actor Ronald Colman, who appeared in Lost Horizon and The Prisoner of Zenda, that he had this marvelous kind of Cary Grant voice, and he did silence too. And it was the kind of thing where Hollywood, once they realized they were going to have to move into talkies, they were like, let's record this guy, see what he sounds like. And they're like, wow, perfect. And Joan Crawford had that similar voice. Like, she didn't sound like Ronald Colman, but Joan Crawford had a very distinctive, very memorable voice. And when you think that she started her career doing silence and how much of that, you know, how much of a presence she had in film with one hand tied behind her back, you weren't hearing her. And yet then when she finally got to hear her, you're like, wow, not only was she a great actress and she had this striking face and these amazing eyes, but her voice was incredibly powerful to listen to. So what a boon for, I mean, a lot of actors didn't make it out of the silent era because their voices weren't, I mean, that's what Singing in the Rain is all about. And yet Joan Crawford was able to just make that leap pretty effortlessly, because if you go and you look at her career, all of a sudden she's in these huge movies. And then, like I mentioned, like by the time 1940 comes around, she's at the top of her game. She is one of the biggest stars Hollywood has.
Yes, definitely. And you're right. I find that transition from silent films to talkies very interesting. You know, I like to read a lot about it. I like to read a lot about the actresses and actors, because it happened so quickly and so many people were just left basically in the dust, you know. And another thing about Joan Crawford that I find fascinating is, what's it like to be the biggest star in Hollywood? I mean, you know, because of her, the name Joan became incredibly popular in the 30s and 40s. And to go from this high to ending your career with something like Trog, you know, I think about that a lot. Like, what is it like, you know, your star is so bright and shining. And I think it has a lot to do with different decisions that she made and who she was as an actress. And I'm basing this, of course, only on my own opinions, right? It's not like I knew her personally, but, you know, I think it's easy to map a trajectory of how this all happened for her.
Yeah, if you go and you go through her IMDb list and you look at, especially when you get to the 1940s, you see some of her movies, she is by far the biggest star in it. And if you look at like the posters, they're not even promoting what the movie is about. It's Joan Crawford in title. And the poster is a giant close-up of her face. And that's it. That's it. That's the whole pitch. And you're like, wow, that's how big of a star she was, that Hollywood could sell a movie based on, hey, it's the new Joan Crawford movie. Doesn't even matter what it's about. You don't even know. I mean, you could kind of go from the posters that it's probably not a comedy. She didn't really do too many comedies. But still, you're like, I don't even know what I'm getting. I don't even know. You know, but that's how big of a star she was. And Bette Davis had that too, where she was that huge. In Hollywood now, where things are still so male-driven and action-driven, it's hard to think of a time that in the 40s, women really dominated Hollywood in a lot of ways, where it's the Joan Crawford picture. That's how big she was. And yeah, as you said, it's when you see this movie, Trog, you're just like, and you see her in it, it is distressing, because you just feel like, oh, good Lord. This is someone who was used to hobnobbing with Clark Gable and Spencer Tracy and Greta Garbo. And now she's trading scenes with a guy in a gorilla mask.
You know, exactly. Like, oh, man. And isn't it interesting how she's still top billing in Trog, right? People are still watching it because Joan Crawford's in it, but for a completely different reason. You know, you're watching it because you want to see Joan. You want to see, but you don't want to see the train wreck that is Joan Crawford in this terrible movie at the sunset of her career. So it's a completely different, you know, thing. And I believe, if I recall correctly, I believe I read somewhere that she said that toward the end of her life, she refused to discuss her last three movies. She would not answer questions about them. You know, and she retreated from public life. I think it was in 1974 was her last public appearance, and then she died in 1977. But, you know, before she kind of faded, she said she didn't want to talk about her last three films anymore.
That's understandable. Apparently, she did Berserk and Trog for her friend Herman Cohen, who was a movie producer. Herman Cohen, we'll get into his filmography. He's got some pretty remarkable stuff back in his filmography. But he did this as a favor to her. And the sad thing is about both these films. Have you ever seen Berserk?
I have.
Berserk is terrible. But the problem with it is you can tell that it wasn't written for Joan Crawford. And he just sort of was able to, like, well, I got a movie star. I can plug her into these roles. And you could sort of tell that they didn't really rewrite the roles to suit Joan Crawford. They just sort of plugged her in and probably, you know, scratched out the name of the male protagonist and wrote in her name. And that was the extent of it. I mean, there's a line in Berserk where Joan Crawford is romancing a guy who is half her age. And I mean, she looks like his mother. It's just, she's dancing with this guy and she says the line is, so it's agreed then. You'll get 100% of the you'll get 50% of the circus and 100% of me. And you're just like, oh, and you're like, come on, Herman. Like, what are you? No, come on. What are you doing to Joan Crawford here? I mean, what are you doing to her? And, you know, I guess she was such a professional, despite her reputation as being difficult. I guess she was such a professional that she was like, I'll just do it as I'm told. As opposed to saying, can we redo this line? Like, it's just really cringeworthy. But at least on some level, Berserk holds up as a quasi thriller. It's got some stuff that's interesting, but Trog, we're trying to avoid talking about Trog, even though that's the subject of the movie. So, I mean, let's just get right to it. As we said, the film is Trog. It was released on September 18th, 1970. The plot, such as it is a three junior anthropologists go exploring in a small cave in the hills of England. They run afoul of a primitive half-man, half-ape troglodyte who kills one of the men and wounds another. The wounded man is brought back to a research center run by a Dr. Brockton, Joan Crawford, a renowned anthropologist. In the interest of science and the potential groundbreaking discovery of this missing link, she gets the creature to the surface and then brings him back to her lab for study. As she and her daughter, assistant Anne, try to communicate with the being they now call Trog, trouble is brewing. A few of the locals, now aware of Trog's existence thanks to media coverage, are none too happy about the idea of a monster in their neck of the woods. The most vitriolic critic is a local businessman named Murdoch, played by Michael Goeg, who is not only afraid of the negative commercial consequences, but is also suspicious of a woman heading a research facility. While trying to keep Murdoch and the others mollified, Trog is taught by Brockton to play and share, and the capacity for language is induced by a number of surgeries and a mysterious hypnotic device that causes Trog to see and relive his distant past, including clashes between various dinosaurs. After a court decides Trog must be protected, Murdoch breaks into Brockton's lab, releasing Trog into the countryside, hoping he will be killed by the local authorities. After Trog kills three people, he kidnaps a little girl who reminds him of the doll Dr. Brockton gave him to care for. Brockton confronts Trog back in his cave and gets him to hand back the girl unharmed. Then, ignoring her pleading, the army bombs the cave and shoots Trog to death. A reporter asks Dr. Brockton what she thinks about what has happened, but she is so disgusted, she simply walks away. Okay. All right. The cast is Joan Crawford playing Dr. Brockton. Michael Goeg, as I said, plays Murdoch. Bernard Kay is the inspector. Kim Braden is Anne Brockton. David Griffin is Malcolm. John Hamill is Cliff. And Joe Cornelius plays Trog. The film was directed by Freddie Francis. We'll get into his credits shortly. And was written by Aben Candell and Peter Bryan. So, okay. So, Aaron, I mean, when did you first see Trog?
It was several years ago. I can't remember exactly when, but I was definitely, you know, as a fan of Joan Crawford, you know, I prefer, not surprisingly, her films, her capital F films like Mildred right. Pierce, Possessed, Dancing Lady, and her older films. In general, I prefer her older films. So it wasn't until probably a couple years ago that I saw it. And then I rewatched it, of course, because I knew we were going to discuss it. Just a few nights ago. So I've most recently seen it a few nights ago. Yeah.
So what, I mean, how do you, what's your overall reaction to it? I mean, just as it.
Okay. So this is my overall kind of reaction to it. You know, on the one hand, there are moments that are bearable. I don't think it's as fun, as a camp film or as campy as Berserk. So I think that, you know, I think some people disagree. Some people love Trog as a camp film, but it's almost not campy enough for my taste to be campy enough. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like there's these moments of passable acting on Joan's. Like, I feel like Joan did the best with what she could. I know that she, you know, from what I've read, she had to use, I'm using the air quotes, idiot cards, you know, I don't like that term, but of course, like with her lines, taped up. They called them idiot cards. I don't call them idiot cards. I just want to clarify. Nice. But I think that she, you know, had a serious substance abuse problem at the time. So she struggled on the set from what I read. But all that, taking all that into consideration, the terrible writing, the terrible concept that made no sense, the fact that she couldn't remember a lot of her lines because of her drinking problem, the fact that she had to do costume changes in her car, right?
Oh, that's...
And she had to bring her own wardrobe. There were no trailers for her to change into. Taking all that into consideration, I think she does the best with what she's got. But, you know, the movie itself, of course, is utterly ridiculous. And I think the parts that where I cringe and laugh and kind of hide my eyes is when anytime she says, in the name of science.
In the name of science.
In the name of science, we cannot let Trog die. you know, and it's just kind of like, and then the dinosaur montage.
Oh, Lord.
That made absolutely no sense. That clearly was footage from something else, right? Yeah. Like a documentary.
It was from a documentary about dinosaurs. You can't make a documentary about dinosaurs, kind of. But it's, yes, it was footage cribbed from another film. And it's dinosaur stop motion by Willis O'Brien, the great guy that did King Kong. So, yeah, it was lifted from a sort of nature film about dinosaurs.
Yeah. So you're just kind of watching it, and it's one of those moments. You know how you watch these films, and there's a moment, and I have this with books and movies, where you think, what the hell am I reading right now, or what the hell am I watching right now? And I think the dinosaur montage is that moment. I mean, there's a lot of ridiculousness before we get to that dinosaur montage, but it's kind of just there. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, oh, we have this footage. Let's incorporate it. It has really nothing to do with the story.
Yeah, the movie stops to show us another movie.
Yeah, that has nothing to do with anything.
Not a good sign. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Trog is only 90 minutes, but it feels much longer.
Yes.
I don't know if you felt that way, but as I watched it, I saw it many years ago back when I worked at a video store. Because I will admit, when I watched it, at the time, you're talking the 90s, it was kind of as like a hate watch. You know, I didn't know much about Joan Crawford. I knew her via Mommy Dearest and Baby Jane and some other things. And I was like, oh boy, let's watch this, you know, great Hollywood icon get dragged through the ringer here. And as I watched it, I kind of did feel bad for her. And you're like, yeah, this is just dismal. And then when I rewatched for the show, you can immediately see that it's padded. Because the opening sequence features these three guys, these anthropologists, you know, spelunking into this cavern. And first of all, they try and find – they're like, oh, look, we found this remote cave. The whole of the cave could practically be seen from space. You're like, guys, how is no one – they're acting like they just discovered this thing. And it's like you could see the hole from 2 miles away.
It's as big as the plot holes in the film.
Yeah. I mean, you could drive a car into this cave. So it's like, guys, you didn't discover anything. It's, you know, like, what are you talking about? And the opening sequence featuring these three actors where they go down and they find – they're splunking down and then they find this like a pool of water. And the sequence where they – wade through all this goes on way too long, just way, way too long. And that already told me right there, okay, they're trying to pad this film out because this sequence just doesn't need to be this long.
Yeah.
I get it. I will say it was sort of funny when they get to the scene with the three guys and they find the pool of water, one guy strips his clothes off, gets down to his underwear and jumps in the water. And cause he wants to see what's underneath this thing. And he goes, and then the second guy, when the first guy doesn't come back, the second guy strips his clothes off, right? Now, the second guy, I mentioned him, that's actor John Hamill. When he takes his clothes off, he is ripped. Like, he is super ripped, way more ripped than you would expect from a guy in, like, a 1970s movie. And I was watching it with my fiance, and she was like, oh, my God, look at this guy. And I was like, that's – and I looked him up, and John Hamill was less of an actor than he was a pinup guy. He was a male pinup kind of model. And I'm like, oh, now I see. They got him because of his build. That's why they wanted him to be impressive like that. So, okay, it makes sense. So they go, and that's when they discover Trog. And unfortunately for this film, Trog, he's not a puppet. He's an actor. As I mentioned, it's Joe Cornelius. But as a effect is comically bad. It
yes.
is – Trog's head is a primitive ape mask borrowed from 2001 A Space Odyssey. And then he's got furry hands and furry feet and, of course, a furry kind of loincloth. And then he's just bare-fleshed. Why they didn't have the – like, they were – was the budget so low they couldn't put the guy in full-on fur? It's comical, and he's not scary. And it just – immediately you're like, oh, is this what this movie's going to be from now on, this guy? And it's just – you know, right from that opening scene, you're like, all right, now I know what I'm in for.
Yes, it's absolutely terrible. And you know, of course, he's been living in this cave. We're supposed to believe, right, that he was frozen in this cave.
Right.
For who knows how long, because apparently he was alive with the dinosaurs.
Which makes no sense, right, yeah.
But he's been frozen in this cave and somehow survived. I guess he got unfrozen. It was a little, you know, not unclear, because Joan Crawford in her best Dr. Brockton voice explains that he was obviously frozen, you know, and then he unfroze and he's been living under there. But he, like you said, he's most of his body is hairless, right? And he's got not a scratch on him, and he's been living. Yeah. He comes out of the cave. Now, presumably, he's been in this cave, which has an inexplicable light source, right?
Right, yeah.
when the guys go spelunking in this cave, they have these little flashlights, but for some reason, the cave is fully lit, you know?
Yeah, yep.
But Trog has been in here in the dark, and then he kind of comes out. I mean, this was one of the moments where you're just like, oh, no. He comes out of the cave, and he like, lifts his forearm, and because the sunlight is just burning his face, and he's like, ah! And then that's it, you know? And then he just walks out. He's fine.
Yeah, I mean, he's been in the cave, what, a couple of 100,000 years? And
yes.
He thought to wander out to the – he's probably about a couple of miles away from the entrance. Like, God, you've really had time to explore this cave, Trog. What are you doing, buddy? You know, come on. I mean –
Yeah, in fact, the cave is so accessible that when the military and the press come, they literally just drive right up to the cave. You know,
yeah,
there's like cars and crowds everywhere.
Yeah, it's like by like a main road.
Yeah.
Like the cave is like, it's not like, I mean, you know, Indiana Jones had to hunt harder for the entrance of the cave in the beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark than they do for this thing.
And when Joan, at the end, when Joan goes in, of course, they're like, you can't go in, Dr. Brockton, you know, because she wants to save Trog.
Yes.
She charges in her beige pantsuit, which gets not a drop of dirt on it. And she just kind of goes in there. It takes her all of 2 minutes to get to where Trog is. But yet he's been frozen under there for you know, like 20,000 years or something.
Oh, man. The people behind this film, as I mentioned, it was directed by Freddie Francis, who had a career both as a director and a cinematographer. As a director, he did movies like The Evil of Frankenstein, The Skull, which is a movie I have never seen, but it has one of the greatest posters in the history of films. If you go to IMDb, look up The Skull. The poster makes you want to see the movie. Dracula Has Risen from the Grave. Tales from the Crypt, which I actually love. I love that movie, the Tales from the Crypt movie from 1973. As a cinematographer, though, he was the best of the best. He shot films like The Innocents, which is a masterpiece, Saturday Night, Sunday Morning, The Elephant Man, Dune, Glory, and the Martin Scorsese Cape Fear. He won 2 Oscars. As a cinematographer. So, I mean, this guy was – Freddie Francis was no hack that Herman Cohen hired. And, you know, you mentioned earlier that the film isn't really camp because it's sort of just good enough to be bad, if that makes any real sense. And I think that's because you've got Freddie Francis directing. You've got a real director here. This is not this is not one of these kind of one-shot hacks that a lot of these other films would have been typically done by. So it's got just enough good people behind it to make it good, but the material is so poor that there's only so much Freddie Francis and Joan Crawford are going to be able to do. It was written, I mentioned the writers, the screenplay was by Aben Candell, who, by the way, over the course of 40 films had 3 different names that he wrote films under. So take that for what you will. He wrote Berserk with Joan Crawford. He wrote Conga, which featured, which was a King Kong ripoff with Michael Goeg. Again, I Was a Teenage Frankenstein. I Was a Teenage Werewolf. Presumably he never got around to I Was a Teenage Mummy or something. And then he did a movie called Craze, which was directed by Freddie Francis. The original story, as I mentioned, was by a guy named Peter Bryan, who wrote a film called Blood Beast Terror, starring Peter Cushing, which Peter Cushing apparently referred to as his worst film. And he did Plague of the Zombies and Bride of Dracula. So these were all kind of like the writers and the producers were all kind of B-grade guys who managed to rope an A-list star in this movie. And that is part of the thing that's so discordant about this film is that I think if it had starred a B-level person, in a weird way, it might have been a better movie because it would have fit more. But when, you know, they bring the wounded guy back to the clinic and it's run by – we see it's Brockton, you know, we see the name. And then we're introduced to Joan Crawford. It just feels like we've entered a different movie. You're like, wait, why is Joan Crawford in this movie? Like, it just feels very discordant.
Yes, I agree. And that's a really good point. I feel like, you know – obviously, it's not her acting masterpiece, but I feel like it could be one of those movies that you love to hate, that's campy, that you can rewatch and laugh But I think for a lot of reasons, one of them being that Joan Crawford is actually talented and she's doing her best that she can with the material, but also that she herself, I think, with the knowledge of you know, at that point in her life, she was largely a tragic figure, you know, if you know anything about her. And I think, you know, at least for me, it makes it difficult for me to, you know, laugh at it. You know, for example, with Mommy Dearest, which, you know, obviously she wasn't a part of, but with that's a campy film that can make you laugh, even though despite the subject material, just because Faye Dunaway's acting is so over the top, all the other acting is terrible. But in this film, if the acting had been terrible and over the top, it would have been better as a camp film. But, you know, you almost believe her. You almost believe that she's Dr. Brockton, right?
Yeah. I mean, you could sort of transpose her performance into another movie that didn't feature a primitive caveman troglodyte running amok and then just countryside. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
The scene where she's taking care of the guy who was wounded, her performance is nothing that you could not imagine in black and white in a 1943 movie.
Absolutely.
It's the same style of acting. And there's times where you feel like Joan Crawford doesn't really know what movie she's in, because the style is, as you mentioned, it's like if they had gotten, like let's say this is probably already was written, odds are it was written for a man. You know, Dr. Brockton was probably originally a man, because generally movies of this type were.
Yes.
If they had handed this to Peter Cushing and Peter Cushing had played Dr. Brockton, you would know what this movie was. You could imagine it in your head.
Yes.
Where he would be good with Trug, you know, hand me the doll, Trug. You could imagine that. But Joan Crawford just feels like she's almost been like CGI'd into the film, kind of. And part of it too is, you know, part of the responsibility that a filmmaker has when they land a big movie star, and maybe someone at this point in her career where Joan Crawford was vulnerable in terms of her career wasn't going super well and she probably needed the work, it is the responsibility of the filmmakers to not make your actor look dumb. You know, you want to make them look good. And I don't know who did the costuming for this film, but they don't do her any favors. I think her giant yellow Margaret Thatcher hair isn't terribly complimentary to her. And as you mentioned, these neon colored pantsuits that she's in are just don't fit in this movie. And she just doesn't look right. And I feel like that's the filmmaker's fault. They should have said, you know, after the first scene, they should have been like, wait a minute. This doesn't look right. Let's give her some dirt. She doesn't dress like you would imagine an eminent physician to be dressed like. I don't know. Am I crazy there?
No. And I think it's because of a couple things. I think, first of all, she's bringing her own wardrobe, so I can only assume that she costumed herself.
Right.
And maybe that's not her strong suit, right? That's a very specific
skill set. Why would she know how to do that? Right.
Exactly. And I know that she, you know, Joan Crawford was famously vain. Vain is even a capital letters vain. So she had her face taped back to kind of smooth out her wrinkles, and the wig that she wore was to kind of mask all the tape that she had to fix her face. Not fix her face, but in her mind, fix her face. Right. And so I think that those things certainly did not serve the narrative well. And I think honestly that her vanity, and I'm not throwing shade, you know, I can be very vain myself, but I think that her vanity was one of the things that ultimately took her career where it did. Because, you know, with Betty Davis, for example, with whatever happened to Baby Jane, you know, Betty Davis was like, I want the close-ups because I'm going to emote my ass off in this role. And I want people to see how crazy I am and how crazy I look. And Joan was like, I don't want any close-ups because I don't want anyone to see my wrinkles. And I feel like between the two of them, Betty Davis, you know, I feel like I'm kind of oversimplifying, but she was very much more about the work was the most important thing to her. And with Joan, I think the most important thing to her was the stardom. Mm. And that's not to negate that she was a fantastic actress, because she absolutely was. But I think when you prioritize those things in different ways, it can really I think it damaged her. Well, it damaged Joan's career because there are parts that she passed up because she didn't want to play someone over 40, even though she herself was well over 40. Mm. There were roles that she didn't want to take because, like, decent roles, because she didn't want to play an older woman, even when she was an older woman. And she didn't want to play someone's mother. You know, she finally did Mildred Pierce, but all these things, I feel like she got in her own way, you know, because she wanted to be the 1930s, 1940s Grand Hotel superstar. And unfortunately that doesn't stand. I mean, eventually your beauty fades and younger, you know, women like Marilyn Monroe come up and nobody cares about you anymore as far as being a sex pod. Right. So,
right. And you have to move on to other roles that are accentuate other features that you have.
Yeah. And then you're also not commanding the box office returns that you used to, but you're still behaving as if,
right.
You know, and I feel like the whole nature with the breakdown of the studio system, the whole nature of Hollywood changed in a way that, you know, she was very much old Hollywood and it didn't quite fit anymore. You know, I don't know that she adapted as well as someone like Betty Davis, who, by the way, was quoted as saying, if she had to do a movie like Trog, she would commit suicide.
Betty throwing some serious shade there over at Joan. I mean, I, for how much the two of them supposedly really feuded, you have to wonder if Betty Davis didn't, you know, see crap like this and just chuckle. You know, just like, oh, okay, Joan, you're wasting your time doing this stuff. I mentioned, you know, Joan looking ridiculous in this movie. Aside from the pantsuits, there's a scene early on in the film, about a half hour in, where Joan goes into the cave and they put her in like a tan tracksuit, and they put a spelunker's flashlight on her, like a coal miner's helmet. And she's down there and she just looks ridiculous. It just looks absurd. And yeah, and you just have to think, what is the great Joan Crawford doing wandering around these stupid sets pretending to look for a troglodyte? You're just, oh, it's just so sad. And then, you know, after, again, a couple more scenes where she, first of all, we get to see her handling a rifle where she shoots Trog with the hypo gun. If you want to do a drinking game with this movie, take a drink every time she asks someone for a hypo gun. She has a lot of, Susan, get me the hypo gun. And you're just like, oh my God. And it's at this point where Trog wanders out of the cave that we're introduced to probably my favorite character in this movie, outside of Trog himself, which is Michael Gog as this local businessman named Murdoch. And it is Michael, and for anyone listening to this, you're familiar with Michael Gog. He, of course, played Alfred the Butler in the four Batman movies from the 80s and early 90s. His role in this movie is to be a gigantic asshole. That's it.
Yes.
That's his whole point of the movie. He is someone who is going, I don't want the taxpayers having to pay for Trog. Let's kill it. And you're like, what? How is this guy being allowed into the meetings? We have discovered the missing link between humans and apes, and he wants to kill it because of taxes? Like, what are we talking about? And Michael Gog comes into this movie. It's like, I almost feel like the director, Freddie Francis, is like, Michael, you're doing like a 10 and we need like a 7. If you could do that, that would be great. And Michael Gog then said, I'll give you a 15, because he's just, every scene, he's just screaming at the top of his lungs about how much he wants Trog murdered. And it is, to me, that is my favorite part of this movie, because it is so ridiculous. Like, what are you doing? Just get out of this movie. He's ridiculous.
Yes. You can imagine the script. You know, sometimes whenever I'm watching films, I think of what the script looks like. You can just imagine that all his lines end in 5 exclamation points.
Oh my God. The minute he enters the scene, you're like, okay, here comes trouble. Cause he's just going to be, I want to kill Trog, Dr. Brown. And they do, I don't want to overstate this, but they do subtly suggest that Dr. Brockton, the reason that he doesn't like Dr. Brockton is because Dr. Brockton's a woman, that he's just sort of like, you know, let the men decide this. I don't want to put too much this is like some sort of feminist screed in this movie, but I did get the sense that part of the reason Murdoch doesn't like her is because he just thinks, what is this woman? Or that because she's a woman, she's, you know, softer on Trog than she should be, which is, you know, again, ridiculous.
Well, I mean, yeah, Murdoch, he was very entertaining as a character, but I have to say his motivations as a character are the plot hole, the holes in there are about as big as the hole into the cave that's next to the frontage road.
Yeah.
It's like 100 cars driving past.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Now, the scenes in the lab where Trog is cooped up in the cave and they try and teach Trog some language, and they give him – there's this wonderful scene where they have to give Trog a bucket of fish to survive on. You get to see Joan Crawford throw a dead lizard into a cage as Trog scarfs it up. Joan Crawford shares most of her scenes in those moments with this actress, Kim Braden, who I looked up, and she did a lot of British television. Her one credit that really popped out at me, her final, she's still around, she's still alive, but her last film was playing Jean-Luc Picard's wife in Star Trek Generations.
Interesting.
And I was like, how did she land that? And then I see she is married to David Carson, the director of Star Trek Generations. I went,
it all falls into place.
Falls into place. So there you go. unfortunately for Joan Crawford, Kim Braden doesn't really give – she doesn't do much. Like, she doesn't give much of Joan Crawford to react to. Like, you know what I mean, in terms of having another actor to bounce things off of? She's sort of dull. So poor Joan Crawford is just kind of, again – set adrift in these scenes with Trog, where she just has to stand there and talk to Trog, and you've got Joe Cornelius, you know, grunting and whatever. And apparently Joe Cornelius said that he found dealing with Joan Crawford actually to be quite pleasant. He said that she was very nice and that they exchanged Christmas cards for years after this film was completed. They still kept in touch, which is very touching.
It you know what? And that's one of the things that I find so fascinating about Joan Crawford, because you could ask, you know, if you get a room of 10 people, five of them will say she's the biggest bitch who ever lived. Oh, she's got a diva complex. The other five will say she was the nicest, most polite yeah. woman. She was very, very dedicated to her fans. She answered, I believe she answered every fan letter if she could that she ever received. And wow. I'm talking about back in the 30s and 40s, when you can imagine how much mail she would get. And she had assistants helping her, but she insisted on signing her own letters. And at the end of her life, you know, she went from having the sprawling mansion in Hollywood, you know, answering buckets and buckets of fan mail, to a small apartment in New York, in the last days of her life, still typing on a typewriter individual responses to fan mail, which had dwindled, as you can imagine, to almost nothing. And she actually developed kind of pen pal friendships with some fans because she was she developed that much of a relationship with them. One of whom wrote a book about her. And if you read biographies about Joan, you also get so wildly different pictures, you know, like there's one that's just, you know, almost worshipful of her and almost in her defense. And then there's others that are playing up the diva angle. I mean, she was just a very complex person, which I find interesting, you know?
Yeah.
So she was very big on Christmas cards, gifts. You know, she was notorious for giving gifts to every single person in the crew on a movie in films that she was working on, down to like the assistant fetching bagels, you know. But at the same rate, she had absolutely had, you know, diva characteristics for sure. So
I mean,
she's kind of all those things.
Yeah, I mean, you can't be surprised that someone that was a major movie star for many decades has a bit of a diva. I mean, I don't know what the term is we have for when it's men that are like that. We don't have a term that is as easily readily usable as diva as a pejorative.
Exactly.
But I'm sure there were men just as bad in terms of their behavior. Not to get off the subject of Trog, although we'd be fine if we did. There was I read a book. I forget what it was about. It was about old time Hollywood, and they were talking about Clark Gable, and they said that Clark Gable really was not comfortable in his own skin. Basically, the reason he became an actor is because he could then be other people, and that made him more comfortable. And the most incisive comment I read about Clark Gable was from Joan Crawford, where she said, in terms of, and she didn't mean this, I don't think, as an insult, but just in terms of explaining how Clark Gable was, despite the fact he was this handsome leading man and, you know, a sexual idol to, you know, millions of women in Hollywood and across America. But she said about Clark Gable, if you see Clark on the lot and you say, good morning, how are you doing? He's stuck for an answer. And I thought, wow, that's an incredibly observant view of this guy that she co-starred in, like, I think like half a dozen movies with.
Oh, yeah. And they had a long-term affair for years and years.
Oh, man. I got to bring this up. Just a couple of days before we sat down to record this, randomly on Twitter, I saw someone took a screenshot from some book, and it was a interview with Glenn Ford where he talked about that he had an affair with Joan Crawford.
Yes.
And I sent you this because it was too funny not to pass up. But basically, there was some evening where Joan Crawford would walk around in this girdle that was almost like a suit of armor, and how many straps it had in it and how much she was cinched. And she basically made Glenn Ford an offer one night and said, if you can get me out of this thing, you can have sex with me, which is pretty remarkable. And Glenn apparently tried to unstrap this thing, and when it finally let go, he said it almost threw him across the room because of the springs.
Yes.
I just love the challenge that Jones set down for Glenn Ford. Like, hey, if you can do it, have at it, Glenn. But
like, yes. And that story was, you know, I had not heard that story, but it surprised me zero, you know, because yeah. she's absolutely was very well known for her sexual appetite, we'll say. And she absolutely used it to her benefit, which is another thing that I find fascinating, because it's another way that she and Bette Davis are so different. And it's hard not to compare them because of their rivalry and because they were about the same age and, you know, all this kind of stuff. You know, Bette Davis was not one to use her sexual wiles to get parts or to get a top billing. And Joan Crawford absolutely, somewhat unapologetically was. And, you know, and it's hard to fault her for that because of the time period. And you know, you're using, she made do with what she had. And she had great talent, but also she had, you know, she was quite the seductress, we'll say.
She definitely utilized everything she had on her disposal. There's a scene in this movie where you see a Coke machine, a Pepsi vending machine, and that was put in at Joan's insistence because her husband was on the board of Pepsi Cola, and she made sure to make sure Pepsi was promoted in every single way. So part of her insistence was product placement in this film for Pepsi Cola. And, you know, that's somebody who is really keeping an eye on the prize, you know, like she's like, if I'm going to appear in this garbage, at least I can get some free advertising for some product that I'm going to make some money out of. I mean, you know, good for her. If you're going to do this kind of movie, why not use every advantage you have?
Oh, sure. Yeah, definitely. And she tried to pull that with whatever happened to Baby Jane. But,
right.
You know.
Man. So later on in Trog, there are two more scenes I want to talk about specifically with Trog before we just get off this, because again, this movie is dismal, but it is sort of fun to watch. You can watch it. It's on Amazon Prime, by the way. You can rent it on Amazon Prime. The one scene we've already mentioned is when this doctor performs surgery on Trog. Again, this is a caveman. You're not going to do that. You're not going to risk. Like, what are you talking about?
Yes, you are, in the name of science, Rob.
In the name of science. Oh, all right. Maybe I don't understand these things. But anyway, they perform surgery on Trog, and they put this metal gizmo on his head where they're basically able to project Trog's memories, and they can watch them. And that's when we cut to footage of this other movie featuring these dinosaur effects by Willis O'Brien. And this sequence goes on, I think, for maybe 5 minutes, but it feels like a half hour.
Yes.
Because it's uncut. It just goes straight through. And, you know, we not only see Trog watching dinosaurs fight each other, we see a T-Rex and a Brontosaurus, I believe, go at it. We literally see, like, the end of the dinosaurs on Trog's watch. So not only was Trog alive during the dinosaur era, which is, as we know, impossible, but he actually lived thousands of years in the dinosaur era, because we literally see, like, a meteor hit the Earth, and we see dinosaurs get sucked into the tar. And turned it. Yeah. So Trog was around for all of these things. He saw a lot of stuff.
We saw a dinosaur hatch out of an egg.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And that's how granular that whole scene got. And by the way, it had no bearing whatsoever on the plot of the film.
No, No, it's just, again, it's for a 90-minute movie. They had to find five more minutes to pad it out. So, again, we see that. And again, it's just these scenes of poor Trog on the operating table and Joan Crawford having to emote over Trog and whatever. You're just like, oh, my God. So then near the end, this Murdoch guy, Michael Gough, gets so mad that he breaks into Brockton's life. Again, you know, this seems like a pretty big discovery to discover a caveman still alive. And there seems to be, what, at most 30 people involved in this whole case?
Yes. And by the way, no cameras. You know, no
world media. Like, no, it's all just British. It's just like, this is like the local color story. Oh, and oh, by the way, at 11:59, we'll talk about the caveman we found in a local hill. Like,
well, we found the missing link, and he's in this little small cage out in the middle, you know, of nowhere with no guards around him, or just like one key to open the door and get in, and like, it's fine.
Yeah, you know? No, it's all right. Yeah, this Murdoch guy just breaks in. There's no security. He breaks in. He lets Trog be free with the idea that Trog is, of course, going to run afoul of the authorities. That's exactly what happens. He kills Murdoch, thankfully. Yeah. So then Murdoch's out of the movie at that point. Then Trog wanders out into the town, and he wanders into this sleepy little town. You can see that it's dawn because it's like the sun is just coming up. And Trog wanders. He starts eating some fruit, a local vendor. And the guy's like, hey, what are you doing? And he tosses that guy into a window. Then the next door butcher comes out. And I do love this scene where the butcher sees this guy stealing fruit. And he went and he grabs a meat cleaver. And he goes after Trog with a meat cleaver. I was like, wow.
That was my favorite part. But also it was kind of, see, these are missed opportunities, right? Because we could have gone full on camp if we'd had more of these scenes. Because, mm-hmm. you know, Trog, he doesn't get Trog with the meat cleaver.
No.
But then Trog kills him. And all of a sudden, we've been watching this film, which to this point, I would not describe as a horror film. But all of a sudden, it becomes like gory because he hangs the butcher. Trog grabs the butcher, right? And then Trog mm-hmm. looks at the meat hanging on the hooks. And you see a little light bulb go off over his head where he's like, I think I know what I'm going to do with this butcher. And then he hangs the butcher on the hook.
On a hook!
We see him. We see the butcher hanging on the hook. And I was like, okay, this is the kind of movie I'm here for, right?
But that was it. Yeah, this movie was rated GP, which was the early 70s equivalent of a PG. And all of a sudden, this thing turns into Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You know,
yeah, like, for just one scene. And then it's back to Dolly's. And like, I'm going to kidnap this blonde-haired girl. And
we do get a close-up, though, of the blood dripping down from the body of the butcher as he's hanging on the hook. I'm like, you know, this is 3 years before Texas Chainsaw. So, Toby Hooper, you hack, you stole it from Trog. I mean,
his eyes are open.
And the hook is poking through his neck. Like, it's like real, you know, you're like, when did we, like, we sort of wandered into a different movie here. Like, all of a sudden.
We wandered into about three different movies over the course of the whole film, right?
Yeah. So then Trog, then he finds his way to a kid's park, and there's a little girl on a slide, and she slides down, and he kidnaps her because she looks like the little wind-up dolly that they gave her earlier on in the film. And again, Trog doesn't mean any harm by it, but he likes the little girl. She passes out immediately. I like to think about when you see kids in movies, and like, think about it. There's a woman out there who is just a couple years like older than us, who's like, yeah, I was in that Trog movie.
That's exactly what I said. You know, like at cocktail parties, guaranteed, that's her story. Like, can you tell us two truths and a lie? You know, and she's like, I was in Trog with Joan Crawford.
No, you weren't. No, here I am. That's me. Yeah, totally. Yeah, I love that. So then everything, it all comes back to the cave where Trog, you see Trog's even trying to pour water into the little girl's mouth. By the way, Trog has learned to talk at this point. So he can say some basic water, and things like that. And then the army, even though Murdoch is dead, the army's decided we have to kill Trog. They blow up the cave. Joan Crawford, you know, Dr. Brockton rescues the little girl. Trog, give me the child. I want you to give me the child, Trog. And Trog does. He's, you know, he's not a bad guy. Please, not a bad guy. And then the army comes in and just mucks everything up. They blow the cave up. Not only do they blow the cave up, they come in and shoot Trog with a machine gun.
Yes.
They just mow him down, and then he falls off of this cliff edge that he's on, and he lands on a stalagmite? What's the one from the floor?
I always forget because one is from the ceiling, right? And one is from
right.
The
there's
floor.
Stalactites yeah. and stalagmites. I think it's stalactite is ceiling because that's top. The tight T for tight, T for top. So which makes stalagmite is at the bottom. And he falls onto the stalagmite and he gets impaled. And the movie ends with this reporter, as I said, going up to Dr. Brockton and basically asking for her comment. And I have to feel like there's more than a bit of a real life here where Joan Crawford is simply so disgusted, she just wanders off and she doesn't even get a final line of dialogue for the movie. She just, and I have to feel like that's maybe Joan Crawford herself, just like, oh, what am I doing in this piece of crap? And that's it. That's the end of the movie.
That's the end of the movie.
That's it for Joan Crawford, for her final film.
And it's kind of like, what were we meant to take away from the film? You know, because Trog dies, science is doomed.
Yep.
And Joan Crawford walks off. And I always, you know, throughout the movie, I was thinking, you know, she was tight-lipped about Trog, you know, especially later in life with good reason. But do you think, like, whenever she was reaching into the bucket and pulling out those plastic dollar store fish and lizards and stuff to feed, I thought, is she, at this moment, what is going through her mind? Is she thinking, what have I done with my life? Is she thinking, what am I doing in this movie? Or is she thinking, this is a good film. This will be a good film. You know, what's going through her mind at that moment? Or maybe she was just drunk and she was like, whatever, this is happening now.
I think she had to know it was terrible. Again, I think she did it out of you mentioned that she valued some friendships very highly, and maybe her and Herman Cohen were good friends and she really valued their friendship. I went back through his IMDb and I couldn't see like where they would have known each other, but who knows how you connect up with, in Hollywood. He did a lot of like Z-grade stuff. He's got a very strange career. I mentioned he did Berserk with Joan Crawford. He produced Dance With Me, Henry, which is the final film featuring Abbott and Costello, one of my favorites. He did The Craze with Freddie Francis, Conga with Michael Gove. He also produced Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla, which is just you have to think that Joan Crawford, despite her friendship with Herman Cohen, must have been mad at him at some point. Like, you put me in this garbage. And I always like to examine, you know, was this intended as a final film? Well, again, you know, hard to know whether Joan Crawford just saw this and said, I'm done. She did have a few other public appearances. She appeared as herself on the Tim Conway Show in 1974. And she appeared in a kind of a horror anthology film, not film, series called The Sixth Sense, where they took footage from a night gallery that she did and repurposed it and put it in an episode of The Sixth Sense. So she did appear on television two more times after Trog, but in terms of a feature film, this was it. And as you mentioned, Aaron, she lived until 1977, so she probably had opportunities to do other movies, but you got to wonder if she just thought, I'm just done. I'm just done with this. I don't want to be embarrassed again. So, she probably didn't really think of herself as like, that's my final film. She probably, as you said, just wanted to forget it.
I think she was just, you know, going about her business. And I know that in 1974, Rosalind Russell had a party in New York that she went to. And it was, you know, I think it was a fundraiser for something. And the papers printed a photo of Joan and Rosalind Russell. And of course they were in the movie, The Women Together.
Sure.
They were longtime friends. And Crawford saw the photo the next day. And she said, I can't believe that's what I look like. If that's what I look like, I'm never going in public again.
Oh.
And she was never seen in public again.
Oh, wow.
And she, you know, Rosalind Russell was asked about it later. And, you know, Russell was kind of like, well, you know, we're older. Kind of like shrug, you know, that's such is life, kind of laughing it off, whatever. But Joan was very, as I said, vanity was her, I think of the seven deadly sins, maybe that was her worst one. And she was just not seen again. She became very reclusive and didn't want to go out in public, which is sad. You know, it's sad that so much value was placed by herself and the industry. I mean, let's face it.
Yeah.
On youth and beauty, which is still the case largely, but especially then. And that's where, you know, you put all your value at the time as a female actress. And it's just, it's sad.
Yeah, I mean, I can't obviously speak to it, but you have to think things are better now in terms of opportunities for actresses and actors of different ages. In fact, just a couple of nights ago, I watched a HBO Max original movie called Let Them Talk, which features stars Meryl Streep, Diane Wiest, and Candace Bergen, who are all in their mid-70s at this point. And it's about them. It's not about some man. It's about yes. these three older women. And it's directed by Steven Soderbergh, and you have to think, it's a shame that these kinds of films, just even 20 years ago weren't made. But, you think about that, what was offered people like Bette Davis and Joan Crawford in the twilight of their careers. Mm-hmm. It's a darn shame. It's a darn shame that this is all that they were, you could do this hagsploitation movies, the Baby Jane movies or whatever, or stuff like this. You're like, she obviously probably still had some skill and some interest in being on the big screen. And this is what she has to spend her career, her final moments on film in a Hollywood career full of highlights, running around with a guy, grabbing a hypo gun and shooting a guy in a caveman mask. You're just,
yes,
it's just dismal. It's just so dismal. But as we said, there are a lot of great Joan Crawford movies out there. You can find them. You can rent them. I've only seen a handful. I've seen The Women, as you've mentioned, and I've certainly seen Mildred Pierce. But there are many great performances out there, and you can, what ones would you recommend? Let's end on something positive. What's, for someone who doesn't know Joan Crawford's career outside of Mommy Dearest, what films would you point to say that this is why I like her so much?
So one of my favorites of hers is Dancing Lady. There's some cringeworthy sexist overtones because this was, the time that it was, but it was her first film with Clark Gable. So it's a fun romantic comedy, which I loved. And I also loved Possessed, which is a little bit later in her career. It's an excellent film. It's a thriller. And I also really enjoy A Woman Without a Face, which is also a thriller. It's also very good. So those are probably my three favorite Joan Crawford films, actually.
Right. Well, I promise that we will do a Film and Water on a good Joan Crawford movie. You were nice enough to do this with me, to talk about this dismal movie of someone you really like. So I the least I can do is have you on the other show to talk about a good Joan Crawford movie. So we will do that at some point.
Okay, we'll do that. We'll have a Joan Crawford extravaganza. And we'll pretend like these last three didn't happen.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Right. You can just erase them all. So that is going to do it for Trog. Would I recommend this movie? Yeah, in a sort of cringeworthy, like, oh, man. But it isn't very good. At least Michael Gogue knows what movie he's in. And he's fun because he's just so awful.
Watch.
He's so fun. He's just – he's chewing his scenery to the point where it's dribbling out of his mouth. And that's fun to watch. And so you could imagine like what this film might have been if you had other actors in it that were really kind of going for it. But nevertheless, it is kind of grimly fascinating to watch this Hollywood legend put through her paces in this final film. And again, I do not tire of seeing Joan Crawford ask for a hypo gun. Like, that's just fun.
Forget it.
Hypo gun. Yeah. This is fantastic. So, well, Aaron, thank you so much for doing this. We've only done two podcasts together at this point, but I look forward to doing more. We have other things that we want to do together. I really appreciate you doing this episode of Fade Out with me. This was a lot of fun.
Yes, it was a lot of fun. And thanks for having me on.
Oh, no problem at all. So why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
All right. So I am on Twitter at Aaron Entrada and Instagram at Aaron Entrada. And if you want to learn more about me and my books, you could visit me at AaronEntradaKelly.com.
All right. Aaron is very prolific. She has, in fact, written three books while we were doing this podcast. I saw her typing away. So.
Well, it's I try to be productive every minute. I try to eke out. I'm writing this book about this troglodyte who was found in a cave.
That is going to be a lit book. I cannot wait to read that book. That's going to be fantastic. So, all right, everybody. Well, like I said, we're not going to wrap up here. I'm going to play some podcast promos. And when I come back, I'm going to have just a few thoughts and doing some listener feedback as we wrap up this era of Fade Out. So stay tuned.
After a long day of criminal activity, there's nothing I like better than to sit down and listen to the old radio. Wait a minute. That's not a radio. It's
Plastic Man. Plastic Man.
That's right, it's the Plasticast, a brand new podcast dedicated to Plastic Man, I'm your host, Max Romero. Together, we'll be talking about Plastic Man in the Golden Age, the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, and every other age you can think of, right up to his upcoming reappearance in DC Rebirth. We'll also be talking about any Plastic Man news that might be coming up, and his appearances in every media from comics to cartoons. Whew. Makes me woozy just to think about it. I hope you'll join me to talk about the longest arm of the law here on the Plasticast, here on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Plastic Man!
Plastic Man! Okay, so a new podcast needs a new promo. I mean, how do I start? I'm J. David Weider. You may know me from the internet. I didn't invent the internet, but the internet was invented for me. No, that's way too egotistical. It's got to be awesome. It's got to catch everybody's attention. Also tell people what the show is about. So first things first, high energy pop music from the 80s. Hi, I'm J. David Weider, here to tell you about my new podcast, Spockward, a Star Trek podcast where I will talk about Star Trek twice a month. I guess that's pretty much it. Wow, it feels like there should be something more there, something grand and something epic. It also has to sum the show up, but I don't want to sound desperate. Maybe I should try another take, but this time there needs to be some epicness to it. Let's try this.
In a world.
Oops. Let me try that again.
In a universe replete with Star Trek podcasts, one guy will challenge the status quo by boldly
talking about Star Trek on the first and third Sunday of every month. Yeah, I probably had it right the first time. Spockward, a Star Trek podcast on the first and third Sunday of every month at Spockward.com or wherever podcasts are accessed. It's Star Trek fandom with a heaping helping of social awkwardness. Spockward. You get it? Yeah, you get it. See you at Spockward.com. Weider out. Did I really just say Weider out? Come on.
And we're back. And as promised, I'm going to be covering listener feedback that we got on the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. But first up, I want to read some Apple Podcast reviews. This is so exciting. We have a bunch of great Apple Podcast reviews, even though this show is so brand new. Thanks, everybody. So let's start with the American reviews that we got. The first up is one from MSG270108. It says, a great angle on movie reviews, 5 stars. Rob Kelly pays tribute to Hollywood greats by using their final films as a springboard to examine their contributions to movie making. Insightful and interesting and filled with a deep appreciation for films and those who make them, highly recommended. Thank you very much, MSJ. The next review is from Kevin Lauderdale. He says, the final films of Hollywood luminaries examined, 5 stars. Host Rob Kelly talks with a wide variety of guests about the final films of Hollywood greats. Appropriately, the films are examined not just as films themselves, but as capstones to the actors slash directors' careers. For the Heath Ledger episode, the resulting changes to the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus and what it meant artistically was discussed. For the Sam Shepard episode, Never Here, he interviewed the film's writer-director Camille Tommen and producer Corey Musa. Lots of details and affection for the films. Thank you very much, Kevin. Desar leaves a 5-star review, the Martini Shot podcast on actors and directors. This podcast covers the last film for an actor's or director's career, which could be better or for worse. We always hear about how someone made it in the industry, but we rarely hear about how they exited the stage. Very entertaining. 5 stars. I say check it out. Thank you, Desar. And then finally, we got a 5-star review from Flash Fan Number One. It says, great premise and hosts. Love the idea of looking at the final movie of a given director or actor. And that Wells episode was sublime. How did you nab a guest host like David Ace? Ah, now I know who wrote this. So thank you very much for the reviews. And I do have one other Apple Podcast reviews from our Canada contingent. I got a comment, a review from Gord Tolton, 5 stars. This is an important podcast. As society continues to lose its film genius directors, beloved actors, and other behind-the-scenes workers, it's important to review the careers and impact of cinema's bygone immortals. And it's truly surprising to see what Rob Kelly has managed to dig up as to what exactly those final performances truly are. The real final acts of Orson Welles and Heath Ledger were both surprises to me, and it's vital to realize big names don't always translate into big projects with household titles. I truly look forward to what this series unfolds, and is a good companion podcast to Karina Longworth's You Must Remember in This Podcast. Wow, Gord, I don't know if I'm ready to co-sign on with that, but that's a very nice compliment. But again, thank you very much for the review. I really appreciate it. I mean, you know, this is a brand new show. And it takes a while for podcast reviews to come in and to get enough of them that there is an average rating that Apple Podcasts can give you. And, you know, there are a million movie podcasts out there. There really isn't, as far as I know, one that's kind of like this. But when there are so many podcasts about a given subject, it's hard to get noticed. And reviews on Apple Podcasts just really, really helps. So I deeply appreciate all of you out there that took the time to leave a review over on Apple Podcasts. I just deeply appreciate it. And it's just a huge help. So thank you. So as I said, let's move over to the comments from our website, findwaterpodcast.com. First up, we have some comments regarding the Fade Out promo where I announced the basic plot or the basic thrust of this show. First up is a comment from Dr. Ange. He says, love the idea. Officially asked to be invited as a guest host. No problem, Ange. You will be on the show. Paul Hicks from the Waiting for Doom podcast and some other shows says, Rob, I'd love to come on and talk about Michael Gross's last film with you. Is that Tremors 9 at this point, Paul? I don't know. I can't agree to that on the air, but you know, we'll talk about it. Chuck Coletta says a couple of suggestions. The Misfits, final film of Clark Gable and Marilyn Monroe. Brainstorm, Natalie Wood. The Shootist, John Wayne. I Could Go On Singing, Judy Garland. Countess from Hong Kong, Charlie Chaplin. The Harder They Fall, Bogart. To Be or Not to Be, Carol Lombard. On Golden Pond, Henry Fonda. Soylent Green, Edward G. Robinson. And Ghost Story, Fred Astaire. Chuck, yes, some of these movies have already been considered. Some guests have already suggested them, so we will be getting to at least some of these at some point. And yeah, pretty much all these I want to tackle because they're all really fascinating in their own way. So thank you for the suggestion. So let's move on to the comments for the first episode where we talked about Family Plot with Scott X, which of course is the final film of Alfred Hitchcock. Matt Saroy says, this is going to be a great series, the perfect film to open up the show. For the record, I do expect episodes on The Shootist and The Misfits. There they are again. And Trog. Hey, Matt, I hope you were satisfied with this episode. It's been quite some time since I've seen Family Plot. It didn't leave a big impression on me, but when I saw it, I wasn't expecting a comedic tone, so that probably skewed my opinion. The way you describe the scene in the jewelry store between Devane and the cops makes me think that Hitchcock was perhaps parodying Dragnet. The flat tone, the one-shot take, and the actors entering from opposite sides of the screen is a sort of hallmark of that series. Again, well done. Another great podcast. Looking forward to more. Thank you, Matt. Steve Givens says, love, love, love the premise of this show, Rob. I look forward to future episodes. I am so glad you started the show off by giving serious consideration to Hitchcock's last and one of his most overlooked films. I agree with the assessment you and Scott X give that although Family Plot isn't Hitchcock, it is most vital or innovative, it is still made with the same amount of artistry and craftsmanship that he was known for. Family Plot doesn't achieve the level of a North or Northwest or Psycho, but it is still a film made by a master who is simply being playful and having fun with the whole time. This movie feels like it comes from a Hitchcock who, being at the end of his career, has nothing else to prove as a filmmaker and has decided to use this film to wink at the audience, both figuratively and literally with that final shot, about the artifice of filmmaking. Finally, I was happy you guys brought up the question debate about how and when seeming mistakes or sloppy filmmaking should be considered when analyzing a film, whether or not these instances should be viewed not as mistakes, but as deliberate choices by the filmmaker. With auteurs like Hitchcock and Kubrick, since he was mentioned in the podcast, I always fall on the side of such moments as being deliberate and give them serious consideration in my analysis. Besides, it is simply more fun to consider the cheesy blue screen and the car chases as a conscious choice made by Hitchcock rather than just dismiss them as sloppy filmmaking. With all that said, I'm anxious to see what the next final film would be. Good luck. Thank you, Steve. That's a bunch of great comments. And yeah, that is something that we will be talking about in future episodes is when you see a mistake, is that a mistake or was it intentional? You never know. And you do have to figure in who is the director attached to the film. And that seems like something they would do. Chris Franklin from our network says, great debut, Rob. Always a pleasure to hear Scott. That's very true. He almost makes me want to venture into Twitter more since the Franklins often spend Saturday nights on MeTV as well. I haven't seen this film, but it sounds intriguing. I need to watch it before weighing it against Hitchcock's other films, of course, but it certainly has an interesting cast. Karen Black was everywhere in the 70s, wasn't she? Off to a fantastic start. Yeah, Chris, I don't know if you really need to be on Twitter. I don't know if anybody really does. But I will say live tweeting Svengoolie on MeTV on Saturday nights is a lot of fun. I enjoy that. So my recommendation would be to log on to Twitter, live tweet Svengoolie for 2 hours. I'd love to hear your comments. And then just log off again. Just ignore it. So that's my suggestion. Nicholas Prom says, I watched Family Plot for the first time this morning in anticipation of this podcast. Thank you for the dedication, Nicholas. I've really only seen a couple of other Hitchcock pictures, but man, I really dug this. Although, apropos of nothing, if you ever want to see William Devane as a detective in a movie that asks, what if the Zodiac Killer / Son of Sam turned out to be a werewolf from outer space with heat vision? See 1979's Dark. You won't regret it. Boy, I hope that's somebody's final film that will be covered here on Fade Out. That sounds awesome. I mean, any two of those elements sounds great. And then you throw them all together. Thanks for the recommendation, Nicholas. Paul Hicks comes back and he says, great opening episode, Rob and Scott. In my headcanon, Frenzy is Hitch's last movie. But yet it isn't. Dr. Ange again says, looking forward to the show. I thought for sure the impetus was Orson Welles' last film was Unicron and Transformers. Yeah, well, we'll be getting to that in the commentary in a moment. I just saw Family Plot within the last 6 months. As you say, it was missing the suspense hook of other Hitch films. I had my phone out throughout. Like you, I thought some parts were too long and some too silly. But overall, I thought it was enjoyable, and certainly I would watch it again if I ran into it. I'd certainly watch it over Torn Curtain anytime. I watch Torn Curtain when I need sleep better than Benadryl. Can't wait to watch more. Thank you, Ange. As a doctor, I take that recommendation seriously. David Gutierrez says, I hope this means we're covering The Crow. Maybe, at some point. Paul Hicks once again says, so Rob, this podcast is replacing Into the Woods, the James Woods retrospective podcast you told me about. Yeah, I'm going to get right on that. Martin Gray from the Too Dangerous for a Girl blog says, I put off listening to this episode till I could watch the film. I've never bothered seeking it out, and as it didn't look to have the tone I want from a Hitchcock. I've still not gotten to it, but I listened to the show anyway. Great stuff, boys. The snippets of information are priceless, and you've certainly made it sound watchable. I hope you are indeed doing Trog. Another vote for Trog. You might consider a complimentary episode in season two on Wicked Stepmother, Verity Davis's last film. I've not seen it, but it sounds epic. I absolutely want to get the Wicked Stepmother sometime. That is a whole story in and itself, because obviously the comparison you got with Joan Crawford and Trog, but it was another ignominious end to a great legendary career. And it's another thing where, kind of like Heath Ledger, the film had to be altered midway through to deal with the absence of the actress, and that Betty Davis walked off the film halfway through. But we'll get to that when we do that episode. Ciscoid from our network says, I'm personally a fan of Family Plot. I would rank it in the middle tier, 4 or 5 stars and a like on Letterboxd. I'm a bit late to the celebration for the new show. Huzzah! So I'll just drop my capsule review of the film. Family Plot was Hitchcock's last film before he became too ill to work, and it's a cheeky romp of a thriller about a psychic who promises to find a rich woman's lost heir, her con man boyfriend who actually does the work, and a couple of kidnappers, one of which is that heir. In other words, the heir has many reasons not to be found and no inkling that they just want to hand him a fortune, rich ground on which to sow the seeds of misunderstandings and suspense. It's not serious enough to be one of the greats, I suppose, but there's a lot to love, especially the crazy car chase at the center of the film. As exciting as it is ridiculous, I love that final wink. Great review, Siskoid. I pretty much agree with all that. Mike Dina says, well done, gentlemen, on a great show debut. I really enjoy the premise of this show, as it can really spotlight some underlooked and underrated films like Family Plot. I like how you talked about the film, but in the context of knowing it was Hitchcock's last. It was almost like having a short career retrospective centered on one film in particular. Scott X was great, as he brought some nice trivia notes and quotes, and you guys both seem to enjoy the movie as a fun romp. I'm sure looking forward to the other episodes, and I'm already wondering what films will be chosen. Orson Welles' Unicron was already mentioned, so I'm hoping maybe Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut or Connery's The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Anyway, this was a fun podcast, and I'm looking forward to more. Keep up the great work. P.S. In my head, I thought this was going to be like The House of Frankenstein and cover a movie and a comic, that comic being The Fade Out, set in the Golden Age of Hollywood by Brubaker and Phillips. Have you read that series? Shamefully, I've not gotten to that yet. It's been recommended to me for years. I think Mike Gillis from Radio versus the Martians was the first person to point it out to me. And I have read some of the criminal comics by Brubaker and Phillips, and I've enjoyed them. I don't know why I haven't gotten around to Fade Out, but yes, I need to get to that at some point. But I would never try and copy the format of The House of Frankenstein, because I would never be able to do it as well as Christensen do it. So it's a fool's errand to try. So next up is episode 2, where we talked about the final film of Sam Shepard, Never Here, with my guests Camille Tommen and Corey Musa. Matt Saroy says, Mr. Kelly, this is a fan— so formal, Matt. This is a fantastic show. I hope you expand it beyond your planned 5 episodes. This was a great discussion with Camille and Corey. I've yet to see Never Here, but I'll be renting it from Amazon over the weekend. Yay, Matt. Sam Shepard was an amazing talent, multi-talented, in fact. He was one of those actors that truly disappeared into his role. You never saw Sam Shepard on screen, only the character he was portraying. True enough, Matt. Thank you. Mike Dinas says, what a great episode, everyone. Well done again to the director and producer, Rob. You had some really great conversations about the movie and the symbolism in the movie. It was great to hear all the behind-the-scenes information that Camille and Corey brought to the show. I haven't been able to see this movie yet, but with your discussion, it really makes me want to watch it. I'm interested to see what horror movie Camille is working on. Keep up the great work. Yeah, me too, regarding the horror movie that Camille is working on. And I said, I have to give a special shout out to Camille and Corey for doing that episode with me, because I actually told Corey about Fade Out before I had ever launched it. And his enthusiasm for the show in concept, and then for doing the episode, really helped spur me to get it off the ground. I've been mulling over doing the show for about the entire length of 2020, and just sheer laziness prevented me from getting to it. And then as I started to build up momentum, Corey really kicked it into overdrive by saying that he would do the show. And that was just an amazing thing to be able to talk to the filmmaker. So big thanks to Camille and Corey for helping Fade Out even become a thing. Paul Hicks once again says, I remember when Rob used to podcast with non-famous people. Great episode and conversation, Rob. I don't know. I always will have time for the little people. Steve Givens says, great interview review, Rob. It's so cool you got to talk with the writer and director and the producer to get some inside information on the making of Never Here. Now I have another film to check out on my ever-growing list. Also, totally agree that Shepard had an unusual and eclectic film career. He was a character actor with leading man looks, and his presence typically elevated at least the scenes he was in, if not the whole film. Oddly, one of the more memorable scenes for me from Steel Magnolias is when his character, Spud, finally speaks to his wife, Truvy, played by Dolly Parton, and expresses sorrow over Shelby's death. In a film full of scenery-chewing, Oscar-bait performances, that small, quiet scene seemed so authentic and real. Thank you, Steve. Yeah, I think I have seen Steel Magnolias, but it's been a long time. I probably need to rewatch it. It's one of my fiancé's favorite movies, and so maybe I'll have to give that another spin, just if anything, just to see Sam Shepard in it. Chris Franklin says, fantastic episode, Rob. I haven't seen the film, but the discussion about the process of movie making was just wonderful. Thank you. Yeah, I really love the behind-the-scenes stuff. That's always been one of my favorite parts about being a movie fan, is learning the behind-the-scenes stuff as much as it is appreciating what's on the screen. And then Chuck Galletta says, another hidden gem from Leighton Shepard's career is Don't Come Knocking from 2005. Directed by Wim Wenders and co-written by Shepard. It's a nice character study, but an actor who's lost his way, a smart film with a fine cast. Thank you for the recommendation, Chuck. That sounds cool. Now we're moving on to episode 3, which was The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, which was the final film of Heath Ledger with my guest Max Romero. Steve Given says, you know, Rob, I understand why you went with The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus as Ledger's last film, as that is what it is technically. But my personal leaning would be toward his last appearance in a complete performance, which would have been as the Joker, given that he intended to film the entire role in Parnassus using any of his footage in the final film, and examining it critically feels like reading an unfinished manuscript from a writer or looking through the preparatory sketches in an artist's sketchbook and treating them as finished pieces. I get why Gilliam et al. Decided to go with the solution they used. I mean, if you could have Heath Ledger, Johnny Depp, Jude Law, and Colin Farrell all in the same movie, why the hell wouldn't you do that? But part of me wonders if it would have been more respectful and better overall for the film to reshoot the scenes Ledger completed with a new actor and leave Ledger's scenes as part of his special features on the DVD or something. I mean, both you and Max mentioned how the actor switches don't really work, and now the film is forever marred as the movie that needed a patch job because its lead actor died. Regardless, I agree with you both that Gilliam's films are always interesting and singular experiences, and The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus is no exception. You bring up some great points, Steve, and one of those points is going to be addressed in a comment in a few moments. But yeah, going into the show, I always thought the idea would be to examine the intention, and Heath Ledger, you know, consciously starred in The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. He didn't obviously intend to happen what did happen, but nevertheless, he did work on it. And while, yeah, I can see what you're saying, that examining it as a final film is a little unfair because he didn't get to finish it. I didn't think the thing Max and I tried to avoid was judging the performance necessarily, because obviously you can't judge his performance because he never got to complete it. But I always assume that any film where the actor is consciously appearing in it by their own choice, then it's worth examining as a final film. And yeah, I mean, I could see that, you know, not using the footage, there's an argument to be made there. But at the same time, if you've got the final footage of an actor who worked really hard on your film, I could see why you always would try and use it as well. And as we said in the episode, Gilliam was lucky that he makes the kind of film that you could even pull that off. I mean, if this had been some sort of straight drama or comedy, substituting the actor midway would have been probably impossible. So he made the best of a bunch of bad circumstances. So again, thank you for the comment. It was very insightful. Paul Hicks says that Two Hands is a great crime film, kind of like Run, Lola, Run, but with a single instance. Interesting. Thank you, Paul. Siskoid says, I haven't seen it. Sounds interesting. There's a morbid movie marathon to be made with this, The Crow, Canadian Bacon, et al. Yeah, I mean, I did worry that the show could become a little morbid when you are just talking about the final films of people. Hopefully, luckily there aren't that many instances where the actor literally passed away in the middle of production. So we won't be hitting too much of that, because that's obviously the grimmest iteration of this kind of show. So hopefully it won't be too much of a downer as we continue on. It'll be more celebratory for a lot of the films that we're going to cover. Dr. Ainge says, thanks for covering this. I tried watching it once, but felt it was so bizarre I had a hard time getting invested. Might be time for a rewatch. I will always watch Terry Gilliam's films. I find so many of them delightful, always innovative. But I find to revisit some of them, Time Bandits, Munchausen, 12 Monkeys, much more than others. Yeah, absolutely, Ange. I agree with that. So Ryan Daly from our network says, listening to you guys discuss this film reminded me yet again of the inclusion of archive Carrie Fisher scenes into The Rise of Skywalker. Ultimately, the choice to use footage of Fisher or the unfinished Ledger performance in Imaginarium comes down to two powerfully unwanted options, but that's the tragedy of untimely deaths. On the one hand, there is a fidelity to the story, the script, the filmmaker's vision. If that was the most important thing, Gilliam should have recast the part and reshot all of Heath Ledger's scenes with the original intended script, keeping the part all done by one performer. I think the movie would have been objectively superior to the compromised version we ended up getting, just as I believe The Rise of Skywalker would have been better without Princess Leia. On the other hand, filmmakers are human with emotional connections and sentiments, and to completely excise Ledger's work from the film, yeah, that's kind of cold-blooded. I can definitely see certain filmmakers making that decision, but if you cared about an actor and his or her work and legacy, I understand the choice to compromise the vision to honor the actor. Are you beholden to sentimental attachments to a particular performance, or do you want to make the best version of the movie you can? Like I said, a difficult, almost impossible choice given the circumstances. Also, what might have happened if the movie was coming out 10 years later and the facial graphics technology existed to put Ledger's face on Jude Law in the whole movie? Anyway, great discussion, guys. Thank you, Ryan. And yeah, there's a whole lot to dig into in that comment. Regarding Carrie Fisher, yes, she is in Rise of Skywalker, but I do not consider that her final film because she did not work a day on that movie. She did not appear on that set. Yes, we know she was planning to be in it, but she never actually worked on it. All of the footage, as we know, is cribbed from the other two films and then digitally put together with some other stuff. So to me, Carrie Fisher's final film is, I believe, The Last Jedi, because that is the last film she consciously worked on herself. Again, I think it's all about intention. The way that I would say that Humphrey Bogart's last film is not Steve Martin's Dead Man Don't Wear Plaid, because yeah, he's in there, but he had been dead for 30 years. He had no, he didn't decide to be in that movie. That footage was taken later on and inserted into the film. So to me, Carrie Fisher, yes, she's technically in Rise of Skywalker, but that's not her final film. And when we get to her, and we will eventually, I think we'll end up talking about The Last Jedi, which I look forward to doing that, maybe with you, who knows. So anyway, yeah, and regarding the facial graphics technology, yeah, that would have been a real minefield if that had happened, you know, more recently, because I think the temptation would have been to do that, to just sort of fake it and have Heath Ledger in there. But then, of course, you know, he's not really giving a performance at that point. Then it's a whole other thing. Again, it's a whole other subject to get into. Regarding episode 4, which was Orson Welles' final film, Someone to Love, with my guest David S. Gutierrez, Matt Saroy says, let's just get this out of the way. Orson Welles' greatest achievement was signing the Muppets to their first big Hollywood contract. Maybe wouldn't argue with that, Matt. Next to Citizen Kane, the greatest movie ever made. Yes, on its innovative, technical, and storytelling achievements alone, it is a masterpiece. Almost everything Welles brought to Citizen Kane is taken for granted by non-adrenaline movie audiences. For me, however, A Touch of Evil is the finest work produced by Welles. Once again, his genius is taken for granted for those who fail to appreciate that long opening shot. My favorite movie with an Orson Welles appearance is the underrated Compulsion, based on the Leopold and Loeb case. I like that movie a lot too. Anyway, one last aside to Transformers the movie. It's been rumored that Orson Welles passed away before he finished recording his dialogue, and then Leonard Nimoy recorded a couple of lines for him, and that is why they modulated Welles' voice to cover up any discrepancies. Mark Baker Wright follows up, and he says, regarding the rumor that Welles died before Transformers was completed, which indeed was thought to be the truth for many years, this rumor was put to rest by voice director Wally Burr at a Transformers convention a number of years ago, before Burr's own passing. Welles did indeed complete all of his lines. No one's sure quite why a few lines do indeed sound different, as though Nimoy recorded them, but the person in a position to know asserts that it was all Welles. Okay, good to know. And there was over on Twitter, at the Fade Out Twitter feed, there was a whole long discussion about Transformers by people much more knowledgeable than me on the subject about it. It seems like it's not quite put to bed, but whether it's all Welles or not, I still argue that even if you couldn't get Welles, even if Welles did die and he didn't finish it, I still think you should have just used his voice and figured out another way to give the other line. I've done something else with Unicron, because again, you're going to hire Orson Welles for the voice, and then it doesn't sound like Orson Welles. Seems like a waste. Rob McCarthy says, the best way to watch Citizen Kane is 13 years old, not knowing anything about it. It blew my mind. That sounds great, Rob. Yeah, that's. We will talk about this on another podcast regarding Citizen Kane. But, I mean, part of the thing that I love about Citizen Kane is that, yes, I still think it is the greatest film ever made, but it is also fun. It's also fun and entertaining. Films that are historically great don't need to be homework. And it's, to me, Citizen Kane is still fresh and vital and just fun to watch. It's a fun 2-hour story well told, aside from all of its historical importance. And I try, for anyone who ever hasn't seen it and asked me if they should see it, I say, yeah, and I do. I do think it's the greatest film ever made, but I also just say, it's just a great story. It's just a great movie. It's just highly entertaining, and that's worth more than all the other context that you bring to it. Eric leaves a comment. He says, an excellent episode. When I was in college, I went through a period of watching every Henry Jaglom film I could find on video. Track, Sitting Ducks, Can She Bake a Cherry Pie, Always, Someone to Love, New Year's Day, and Eating. Then it just sort of fell out of the habit of following it. Most of his films follow the same basic formula of featuring a gathering of people just talking, much like this one. From what I understand, he encourages improvisation from his actors, but in the end, he has control of the story through editing. Michael Emil, the actor who plays Jaglom's brother in Someone to Love, is his brother in real life. Jaglom does seem to bring a lot of his real life into his films. His previous movie, Always, was a fictionalized story of a marriage falling apart, and he actually got his ex-wife, Patrice Townsend, to co-star with him. Maybe it was therapeutic for both of them. I don't know. Getting back to the Jaglom-Wells connection, Jaglom used that image of Orson Welles holding the rainbow as the production for all of his movies, at least during the period when I was following. Yes, I mean, their friendship cannot be understated, how much they really appreciated one another. And I read some articles in preparation for that episode, and, you know, Jaglom still, I think he even released a book talking about some of the conversations he had with Orson. So clearly, they loved each other and admired each other quite a bit. That is going to do it for the feedback for the first 4 episodes of Fade Out. I really do appreciate it. I love getting feedback, and it's great having these discussions, and some of the insights that were left were just really fascinating, and we will be getting to them in future episodes. So as I said at the top of the very first episode, the Hitchcock one with Scott X, this episode, the fifth one of Fade Out, is going to be the last one for a little while. I have a million other shows that I work on. I have too many shows that I work on. And I wanted to just sort of put this one out there. I wanted to get it out there finally, get the idea out there and get the ball rolling before I committed to some sort of ongoing schedule. I'm very, very deadline driven. And to me, once I promise a show at any sort of regular intervals, I really want to make sure I stick to that because I'm very appreciative that anyone listens to my podcasts. There's so much out there to take up people's time. That I appreciate, you know, anytime somebody gives me an hour to listen to one of my shows. So I want to honor that commitment by also making sure I put out shows at the rate I say I'm going to do it. So right now I'm not able to really determine how often I'm going to be able to do Fade Out. I will probably make that announcement at some point down the line. For right now, though, this fifth episode will be the last one for at least a little while. And then the show will be back, obviously, and I will have other great movies to tackle with other great guests. So stay tuned. Please keep subscribing to this feed. You will see another episode of Fade Out appear probably before you know it. And then hopefully we can go on and just examining all of these great movies and all of these great performers and directors and creative types. Because this is an idea I had a little while ago, as I said, again, at the top of the first episode. I've been dying to get to it. And now that it's finally been put out and I've done 5 shows and I've been so fortunate to have really great people to talk to, I want to keep doing it. So thank you, everybody, for your feedback. Thank you for the Apple podcast reviews. That is a huge help. Thank you for listening across all the different platforms. I just deeply, deeply appreciate it. So for now, that is going to do it. So, of course, if you want to follow this show, all the episodes are on the website, fryandwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, Stitcher. We're talking movies over at Twitter at Fade Out Pod. And if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So if you love Fade Out, even though it's brand new, and you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, go to patreon.com/FW Podcast and leave a donation and you can be mentioned here on Fade Out. So finally, I want to thank a few people that were instrumental in helping the show get off the ground. Of course, my guests, Scott X, Corey Musa, Camille Tommen, Max Romero, David Ace Gutierrez, and Aaron Entrada Kelly, who were nice enough to join me for this initial outing of Fade Out. I really appreciate it. I was so thrilled to talk to all of these people, and I think the conversations were for me, just for me to have them, were quite entertaining, and hopefully they were for you too. And I also have to thank Luke Dobb. I didn't mention him in the first episode. I should have. The awesome theme, the awesome original theme for Fade Out, is courtesy of Luke Dobb, a longtime pal, super creative, way too handsome. You can follow all of his creative work over at his website, dobcreative.com. He does artwork, he writes, he's been a podcast guest, and he does original music. It's just, the man is just multi-talented, and he delivered a wonderful theme, so, and it really, again, was a shot in the arm getting this show off the ground, having that awesome theme, to know that I could put it in there and really get it moving. So again, big thanks to Luke for his work. So again, that's going to do it. Thanks for listening, everybody. As I said, this is going to be the last episode for a while. We will be back, but until then, we've reached the end of this particular script, so it's time to fade out.